If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Wine's been in my blood a long time. My parents actually started me early, and I think today, if I were to say this and I was young, they might actually be accused of child abuse of some sort. But
that's so funny, because my vineyard manager over in Sonoma once told me that if I ran into a bear, I had to throw my arms in the air, and if I ran into a cougar, then I had to roll and play dead. And then I thought, well, isn't it supposed to be the other way? And he said, oh, yes. I said, well, you try to kill me?
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 474. This week we feature Keith Emerson, winemaker at Vinoce Winery in Napa Valley. The Vinoce Winery's tasting room can be found in the city of Napa in a cozy space close to the Napa River. Vinoce's winemaker, Keith Emerson, wears many hats when it comes to making wine. You'll learn more about that as we go. That keeps harvest all the more interesting. The fact is, I've always felt that the smaller quantity production a wine label offers, the greater the focus. Yep, small is good. You can also hear Keith on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term zippy. Continuing with our time in Napa Valley, we are here with winemaker Keith Emerson, and Keith is the winemaker for Vinoce. Got it right, right?
You got it.
It's a good start. I'll mess something else up as we go, I'm sure. Thanks very much for taking the time this afternoon. How's everything going for you?
Going well, thanks.
Vinoce obviously is an Italian name. Fair to say, what does it mean?
Wine nut. It's a loose translation, if you will.
Oh. Is it something that you would actually hear in Italian, or is that just sort of a made-up word?
It's sort of a made-up word, I think. Brian, the owner of Vinoce, I think, claims that made-up word.
That's good. I like that. That's some of the best.
It's from his roots, Italian and German heritage.
Sure. Oh, there you go. A little of each. Well, let's talk about the brand first and then go a little into you, but the brand itself. When did Vinoce have its beginnings?
They started in the early 90s. I believe 97 was the first bottling.
Okay, so it's been around 24, 25 years.
Yeah.
Coming up on an anniversary, which is kind of cool.
Absolutely.
And how long have you been winemaker for Vinoce?
I started with them in 2013.
Okay. And your particular career, let's go back to the beginning, all the way back in time. I always like to ask people, were you born into a winemaking family? Were you a young wine drinker? I mean, how did you end up finding your way into being a winemaker? Not a common profession.
No, it's not. I grew up in fine dining and restaurants. My dad was a restaurateur and a wine broker on the East Coast, and so I grew up very exposed to great food and fine wines, and stocking wine cellars when I was 12 years old, and peeling potatoes too. It wasn't all fancy, but did about every job you could do in a restaurant, and sort of fell in love with wine through food. Once I figured out I could actually study it in school, I pursued that pretty aggressively.
The idea, though, of making that leap into being a winemaker, it's... Even though, okay, you have this background, it's still a little bit of a dark alley, isn't it? I mean, to kind of, how is this going to happen? How do I get connected?
Yeah, definitely. I thought I would cook, honestly. I thought I'd go to culinary school. But once I started reading and studying a little bit more about enology and viticulture and, sort of travel, which can come along with winemaking, I got pretty excited about it and sort of jumped on it. And I know my dad was helpful as well. He was telling me that, you need to focus on one variety and it should be Syrah. And I said, okay, I'll focus on one, but it's not going to be Syrah, Dad. But yeah, I definitely had some people in my corner, so.
Why was he so stuck on Syrah?
I don't know. That was the early 90s, I guess. Maybe 91, he said that, 92. And I think it was just one of his favorites. And
sure.
I'm glad I didn't stick with Syrah. I do love Syrah, but, it's not my top variety that I work with, so.
Let's talk about that, the vineyard that this is coming from. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I'm familiar with the Pimerais Vineyard. And is that where this is coming from then, or?
The original Vinoce wines were from the Pimray Vineyard, and that's where Brian and Lori Nuss lived for many, many years and managed the estate and farmed the vineyard for Robin Williams and his family.
Great. And where is it being farmed at this moment?
So next door to the vineyard is another vineyard called Amentet, and that is a 17-acre parcel that is mostly Cabernet Sauvignon and a little bit of Cabernet Franc.
Which I'm guessing is the grape you like to grow.
Yes. Yeah.
Very cool. And it's Mount Veeder?
Yeah, all on Mount Veeder at the end of Wall Road.
And you do whites, you do Sauvignon Blanc, right?
We do. We do two Sauvignon Blancs.
Yes.
Yeah, we do a Napa Valley Sauvignon Blanc, which I source from a few different properties. And then we do Lori's Lucky Penny Sauvignon Blanc, which is a slightly higher price point, spends a little bit more time in barrel. And that's from an Oakville property.
I love the title. So needless to say, or the name, I should say. Where'd that come from?
Lori Nuss had a Lucky Penny that she found, and she used to take it with her everywhere. And I wish Brian was here to tell the story because he tells it a lot better than me. But it was just always her her thing was this Lucky Penny, and she had it in her pocket all the time. And when she passed, we wanted to keep going with that Lucky Penny, of course. And so that's a very special wine that's near and dear to our hearts.
It's very sweet to do something like that. Nice remembrance of that. So for you, as you go on, do you think you're looking into any other potential varietals or any other vineyards that you'd be sourcing from? Or
yeah, we're playing with, we have a little St. Helena Cabernet program that we've been working on, and it's a little bit more price friendly, if you will. You know, the mountain fruit is so expensive, it's hard to get, and it's very expensive. It's hard to not charge a pretty penny for it. But we have a little bit of Valley Floor fruit. We have a St. Helena cab, and then we have an Oakville cab from a single vineyard in Oakville as well. So. Yeah. And even this year in 21, because of the shortages in Sauvignon Blanc, Brian really wanted me to go out and maybe try another refreshing wine. So we did a rosé, a little Pinot Noir rosé. And then we're even playing around with a very small Chardonnay bottling, just to sort of broaden the portfolio a touch.
Sure. That's fair. Now, I say this a lot, and people are probably tired of me saying it, but I always kind of regard winemakers as being a little bit like mad scientists. And you could have that look, put a white coat on you. Yeah, good. Yeah. So do you get that chance to experiment, to do something kind of crazy, or maybe play with grapes you've never really been around before?
I mean, they're grapes I've been around before, but every vineyard is so different, you know. So for me, it's about working with new sites and new vineyards and new vineyard managers as well, and, you know, establishing those relationships and, you know, trying out new things. For Vinoce, I don't know. I know he's been talking a lot about doing a Vermentino, Brian has.
Nice.
And so that might be something we explore. I do know of a couple of Vermentino vineyards that have good quality fruit, so.
Now you're talking about the way of working with vineyards. Have you had a vineyard in particular in your career that you've worked with that gave you trouble other than typical weather?
I work with a lot of Oregon fruit, and and I spent some time in New Zealand. So yeah, I definitely feel lucky to be making wine in California. We have wonderful weather mostly, usually, and usually not too many catastrophes like the fires.
Yeah.
But the California grape growing and winemaking is, to me, it's exciting, it's adventurous, but at the same time, it's a little safer than, you know, I've been making wine in Oregon for 13 years now, and that's a roller coaster ride, but it's exciting and fun as well.
So. Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah. Who are you making wine for there?
I have my own brand that I make here in Napa Valley at Vineyard 29. So it's Sonria is my own little Pinot brand. And then I have another brand that I do a Chardonnay under called At Large.
Nice. Very nice. Many of us have mentors in our career, somebody that really meant something to us or maybe several people. Who would that be for you?
I have a few. I'm fortunate to have a few. There's a gentleman that I worked under in New Zealand named Alan Johnson, an amazing winemaker at Palliser Estate. And here a little bit more locally, Zelma Long was a mentor of mine. Worked with her for a few years and learned a lot. Learned a lot about wine vocabulary from her. Not just descriptors, but true vocabulary of wine when you're trying to express what you're tasting and what you're smelling and what you're feeling. So that was wonderful. And then Philippe Melka is a good friend and mentor that I've worked with for a good 14 years or so.
Yeah, you're very lucky. Very nice. This wine vocabulary, I'm curious about that. I mean, what words for you were new or a challenge to you?
We worked a lot with Chardonnay when I was working with Zelma. It was at Gunlock Bunchy Winery in Sonoma. And she and her husband Phil was there with us, helping us in the vineyard as well. But she taught me a lot about just words and what you're tasting with Chardonnay, what you're smelling with Chardonnay, things like flintiness, things like ginger, and just you know, all these little descriptors that I'd have to sort of ask her a little bit more. You know, explain stone fruits, explain wet stones, explain what that is.
Sure.
And you know, it's so I learned quite a bit about that. That was a long time ago. That was probably 2001 through 2004.
For this experience you have now under your belt, how do you feel about descriptors? Is that something you're still comfortable with, or is that something you leave more open for people?
I like to tell people what I think of the wine, but I also tell people that, you know, it's really what you're feeling and what you're tasting, what you're smelling. You know, you're not wrong. You just, you know, it's an open book. So just figure out how the wine makes you feel and what you're smelling and what you're tasting, and write that down or tell us. But yeah, I don't think it's a specific thing. I think, and it's funny because I can taste the same exact wine with three or four different critics every year, and they're going to say many different words and many different descriptors, and so that's always interesting to me. But for me, it's a color spectrum with red wines. I always talk in the blues, the reds, the purples, the blacks, etc. And I think that's a lot of people know that in the industry, and but that helps me a lot to just put it into a category. You know, this is more blue fruit driven, this is more black fruit driven, you know, things like that.
Sure, that's fair. This idea of sitting down with critics would make me massively uncomfortable. I'm sure it maybe doesn't make you feel any better. I don't know. But
it's easier than being on camera.
Okay. Do you want me to hide the camera?
No,
just kidding. It's actually funny that you'd say that, because I would be intimidated. And this is maybe something I'm not sure if you're going to want to answer, but I mean, do you kind of sit back going, oh, you taste that, huh? Okay, yeah, whatever. I mean, it's got to happen from time to time.
I honestly just work really hard to make sure that everything's perfect for those specific days. And, you know, it's a lot of getting up, sitting down, because you're constantly replenishing glasses and replenishing wines and this and that. And I stay very focused. I answer all the questions I possibly can, and everything about pHs and TAs and et cetera. But I just try to stay very polite, very focused, and it's a fast-moving, you know, event usually.
Sure.
Fast-moving couple of hours.
Sure. I appreciate the fact that you stay polite, because it could get ugly.
Exactly.
Oh, I can't even imagine. No, I wouldn't want to do that. Do you spend a time in tasting rooms at all? Other than, obviously, you do events and dinners, but tasting rooms in general, just to be part of it?
I do, yeah, I do. I like to come down to the Vinoche tasting room and spend some time with them and get to meet their customers, and they do events as well, so I like to come to those events. They're always fun and get to talk to a lot of people and, you know, tell people about the wines.
Yeah. So I imagine most of the time, obviously, people know you're the winemaker, but are there times when you're kind of incognito?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, until someone says, that's Keith, he makes the wine.
Yeah, right. Well, that's got to be
Which
fun.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're getting the truth from somebody.
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to tell anybody. That's just not me.
Yeah.
I'm the quiet one. My wife, she'll tell you, you know, she's the social butterfly. I just stay kind of quiet.
That's fair. That's her job. She's going to promote you.
Yeah.
That's totally cool. But so you're in a situation when you're talking to people, and you don't want to talk down to anybody. You want to make people feel comfortable. But how do you describe scents? How do you describe certain tastes to somebody in a fair way? Because you're so experienced and they're just kind of learning.
I usually try and build them up a little bit. I tell them, this is how I feel about the wine. This is what I think it smells and tastes like. But you're, you know, certainly open for your opinion as well. And so I like to hear their opinions. I like to hear what they have to say. And, you know, they're never wrong. I never tell them they're wrong at all. I just listen and you know, maybe I can sort of persuade them in a certain direction. But I'm very peaceful about it all.
I would imagine it would be, have you had a time where somebody said something so off the cuff for you? You're just
sure.
Double take, yeah? any example you can give me?
Oh, I remember my sister and brother-in-law fighting over a wine, over a Pinot Noir. One of them, because I have taught them a lot about fruit and descriptors and things like that, and one of them thought it was, you know, cigar box and cedar and all this, and it was very far from that, but I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to necessarily jump in and correct them. So I let the other person do that.
Yeah.
And ended up being a little spat, and it was funny.
Oh, no. Well, that way you walk away without any black and blue.
Yeah, I was just harmless. I was moved on to the next wine.
Yeah, that's really God. Do you do your own wine, personal?
I do, yeah. I have a few. We have a few brands, my family and I. Emerson Brown is a wine that my business partner Brian Brown and I started back in 2005, and so we've been making a Oakville Cab and a Napa Valley Cab, so two cabs since 2005. And we make those wines at Vineyard 29.
Gee, that's all the fruit you can get? I mean, come on.
It's cab driven. And then at large, my wife and I do, and that is everything but Napa Valley. And so we have a Sauvignon Blanc from Russian River. We have a Chardonnay from Oregon. And then we have a Cabernet from Bechstoffer's Red Hills Vineyard up in Lake County.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's fun. We love the at-large. And then Sonria, I mentioned before, is my Oregon Pinot.
Right.
From the Shea Vineyard, from Dick Shea.
What does your wife do? Is she in the business?
She's in sales, yeah. She runs a brokerage in California. She used to be the national sales director at Vineyard 29, which is where I work full-time and where I make the Vinoche wines. And she is now the vice president of sales for Swirl Wine Brokers in California.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah.
Man, you're just wearing a lot of hats. For me, as an average person, I know I keep myself fairly busy, but when it comes to harvest, harvest is harvest.
Yes.
And when you're dealing with a number of different labels, does that keep your head spinning?
No, it's exciting. It's fun. And honestly, a wine that's made in the building at Vineyard 29 is treated with the same respect as any other wine that's made in the building.
Yeah.
So whether it's a Vinoche lot or an Emerson Brown lot or a Vineyard 29 lot or anything like that, it's all, it's myself, my assistant winemaker, my two production guys in the cellar, and then we have a few interns. And it's the same team, you know, treating every tank and every wine with the same respect. And, you know, same barrel sourcing, same, you know, I help my clients out with finding glass and corks and labels, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's all in the family to me. And Brian and the Vinoche team are part of our family. So, yeah.
Were you able to harvest any 2002 fruit for any of these? Obviously, speaking strictly about Napa.
2020?
Did I say 2002?
You said 2002.
Well, what's wrong with you? I mean 2000.
I wasn't there yet.
Let me set the question up one more time. Make it sound like I know what I'm talking about. Were you able to harvest any 2020 fruit at any of the Napa wineries you're working with?
Yes, definitely. The yields were so low. So, you know, just yields alone made it a very short vintage. And then quite a few farmers and owners, vineyard owners, requested that I reject the fruit. So I'd have to write a rejection letter and give that to them, and so they could deal with their crop insurance and you know, take care of the vintage that way. But there's quite a few vineyards that we did pick from 2017, and from other research, I've learned a lot about smoke removal and how to deal with it. And you know, I feel very, very confident in the wines that I will bottle for 2020, and I think people would be. I dare them to try and find some smoke. There's no smoke in any of the wines that I'll bottle for 2020. They're beautiful, actually, really nice wines, and I'm excited about them. I've been working hard on some 2020s just this past 2 weeks. My team and I, we took a bunch of wines out of barrel, treated them, did a bunch of things to them, blended, put them back, and just finished that project on Friday. So kind of excited about 2020, honestly. Unfortunately for Vinoche, we have our St. Helena cab, but the mountain fruit did not get picked. We couldn't even access the vineyard. So,
Yeah.
There's quite a few stories where you just couldn't even get up there. So,
yeah, I'm sure it was beyond raisins at that point.
Yeah. So Vinoche will have a 2020 St. Helena cab, but no other, and the whites, but no Mount Beater fruit. So,
yeah, it's tough to have the season where you lose these things. It's kind of like when I talk to people, you lose part of your vineyard, and imagine going home with a part of your paycheck. That's really a rotten situation.
Yeah.
So you're saying you were able to remove the smoke. I've heard of this technology. I'm not deeply familiar with it because I am not a winemaker. I have to imagine this is an extremely complicated process.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, most people don't tell you about it, and a lot of winemakers want to stay hush-hush about that kind of thing. And
sure.
Maybe they're told by their boss to stay hush-hush about it. But thankfully, at Vineyard 29, we're allowed to say whatever we please. And, you know, Chuck McMinn, the owner there, is an open book. You can ask him anything, and he'll tell you the truth. And so I'm the same way with the wines. And, we used some reverse osmosis. We used another technique with a resin column, and we're able to extract and pull out some of the smoke taint molecules with a resin column. So all kinds of good stuff. And then it's about blending too. And it's about being creative. And, you know, there's some fining agents. There's different types of barrels, you know, medium longs instead of heavy toasts, you know, mediums instead of medium pluses, fine grain wood instead of loose grain wood that's going to be a little bit more spicy and toasty and roasty. So just fine grain, finesse driven barrels, a slightly lower percentage of new oak than usual. So things like that, you know, just creative across the board. It's all thinking of one wine, there were 15 steps we took just on each and every one wine. So it's a combination of things.
You must have really had your nose in a book and computer like mad to be able to put this all together, because there's a lot riding on your shoulders for this, because there's an expense involved in this.
Yes. I didn't even mention the ozonated containers. Yeah, at some places we would bring in fruit. We rented these ozonated containers, and so you'd have to pick into these bins that had holes in them, little slots in them, and then you stuck them into a 20-foot container, and you put ozone gas in, and it pumps from the bottom up through the top. And so you'd wrap them with saran wrap, you know, basically shrink wrap, and the ozone gas would penetrate through the fruit and go all the way up to the top. And for 24 hours, it would stay in that box. And then you had to let it come out and aerate and spend like 8 hours outside of the box. And then you crushed. That alone brought the smoke taint numbers from here down to here. And that was really interesting. So we didn't do that at Vineyard 29, but we did at some of my other places.
So just to understand one thing, when you go through that process,
I think it's all about binding. I think the smoke taint molecules bind with something else and then can drop out. Yeah.
For you, you know, you're a busy guy, obviously married, you have some kids who are lucky enough to be here today. Do you get the time to have any kind of a hobby? Do winemakers ever have hobbies? Because it's a busy gig, especially when you're doing it for multiple wineries.
Yeah,
or
we
under
do.
Multiple labels, I should say.
I love my breaks and vacations. You can ask the kids right behind you, but we like to go to the beach. So we do Mexico a lot, Hawaii sometimes, but we love to get away and relax. And then we love to ski in the wintertime. But I'm a runner. I like to run quite a bit. I like to run trails. And when I don't have time, I run around the neighborhood, around Carneros. But I love to run. That's my getaway. That's what I do 4 or 5 days a week.
Nice. It's a good getaway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this can go to the positive or to the negative, but what, and or both, what makes you crazy about the wine business?
Oh, the pretentiousness, for sure. Yeah, that's an easy one. Didn't you have to practice for that one?
Yeah, I know.
It's not everywhere, but it's in quite a few wine regions and around the world. It's not just here, so yeah.
And otherwise, to the positive? I mean, I think of winemakers generally tend to be very passionate. I mean, but you know, is it a part of the time of the year that you're really just nuts over that's really the most important to you, or something to that effect?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love what I do. I feel so lucky to go to work every day. There's never a day, I can tell you, there's never a day that I say, oh, I got to go to work today. You know, it's just not like that. I really enjoy what I do. And that's great. You know, and I'm very lucky to have such a great place to go to every day to make wine. And I mean, I just, great people that I work with, it's infectious, so I really do love that. And harvest for me is fun. It's exciting. I know my team works really hard, and I know I do as well, but I spend a lot of time in my truck, vineyard to vineyard to vineyard to vineyard. I put in a crazy amount of miles during harvest, and basically from late July all the way through, you know, through October, just sometimes 3 or 4 counties a day. That's very regular, very normal. So I'm always talking to people via phone, text, and email, et cetera, throughout the day, but I'm not necessarily in the trenches where my team is working their butts off. And so I really am very appreciative of their hard work as well. But yeah, harvest is a fun time of year for me. It's bottling that I hate.
I haven't heard that before.
Bottling is just, yeah. Ugh. I respect the people that run these bottling lines as well. So.
Yeah, it's not an easy gig. But
oh, man. Pressure.
Yeah.
Intense.
Well, there's so many parts of the wine business that are involved with pressure. I think one of the biggest ones is now finding labor. Yeah. Being able to get people. Labor now is a problem everywhere. But it's been a problem in the wine business for quite some time. How about for you guys when it comes to harvest, since you just finished?
It's very challenging, and it's not only a labor shortage, but the cost, of course. I mean, labor expenses, it's going up. You know, people need to make money to live around here. I mean, that's a fact. Automation is how we sort of try to keep up with that. In the vineyard, there's some unbelievable machine harvesters being created now, being built, and coming out and into full production now. And they're amazing what they can do. And so that's one thing we can do in the vineyard. And then automated leafing and things like that, all kinds of vineyard practices, even those pruners, which are really cool to watch. And in the winery, automation as well. We have a full crush pad with optical sorting, and we used to have 20 people on a berry and shaker table, berry sorting table and a shaker table, and we'd have 20 people out there working their butts off. And now we have 3 people, and we go twice as fast, if not 3 times as fast, and the quality is better. And so that's all through using technology and just a better destemmer, a better shaker table, an optical sorter, you know, things like that. So we're able to use gravity flow, so no pumping.
That's nice.
And fill all of our tanks with gravity, and without having to to have 20 people out there. So
yeah, big difference.
It works. Wow. Works well. But yeah, labor shortages are real, and we were lucky to get a couple of interns this year. One of them, it was their first time in the industry, and the other one was Australian. And I know we can't get Australians here. You know, that's part of the whole. With the COVID and everything, no one's getting the J-1 visas anymore.
Right.
And so we were able to get an Australian here because his mom is from Michigan. And so he's a dual citizen. So he came here. He's a distiller. He's got tons of experience in distillation. So he was very knowledgeable. He's just trying to dip his toes into the wine side of things a little bit. So we got lucky this year with our labor, but it's an issue for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, for every interview I do, I have one particular favorite question, and I'll give you a second to think about it, but only a second. I'm sure you've done your share of interviews in media. What's the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
That's a good one. That I would like to be asked. Well, nobody ever asks how I plan the work week or how I plan the flow of how things go over a period of a month or a week or a year or anything like that. I think that's a huge part of winemaking, actually, a huge part of production is to be organized enough to plan ahead and know what everyone's going to be doing the following week or even the following month. Nobody ever asks me about that.
So what do you do? I mean, is there something special in that process or is it very religious, you know, how you do it?
It's all about trying to stay ahead of the team and thinking of the wines first. So first, I taste a lot. I taste all the lots in the cellar very regularly. And my assistant winemaker and I, we bounce everything off of each other and we try to stay ahead of the game, like I said, ahead of the team, and we think of what are the highest priority things, you know, what needs to happen before other things need to happen, etc. And so, for instance, when we finished harvest and we finally barreled everything down and we did our post-harvest cleaning this year, and the interns, we said goodbye to the interns, you know, had lunch and took them to a few fun production tours at other wineries and said goodbye. The first thing I thought of was the 2020s sitting in barrel, and I said, all right, it's time. Let's go. It's time to work on these 2020s. We already know what we want to do. We've done so many tastings. We already have done all the treatments we will do, and we don't want to do anything else. So we're ready to make the wines so that I can start ordering glass, ordering capsules, labels. Just think of that. There's so many things to order to bottle a wine, and there's so many trucking logistics, and then all the delays with COVID and everything right now. You really have to plan ahead. And so, so for me, it's all about, okay, let's stay ahead. We know that we can give the guys 2.5-3 weeks of work just working on the 20s, and then we'll go into Christmas and into the holidays, and they can relax and take a few days off. What do you want to do when we come back on January 3rd or whatever day it is, you know? Okay, so I'm going to go to the whites. I think the 21 whites probably need a racking. Let's taste them one more time. I think they need one more stirring, but I think in early January, we'll start working on the whites and we'll put the whites together. We'll put the pinks together, a few rosés, you know, and I just try to always stay ahead and always think of wine first. So yeah, kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, well, as the head guy, you really have to be organized.
Yeah, you try to stay at least a month ahead, honestly, just in your head, at least in your brain. So.
Sure, sure. That's important.
Yeah.
Well, most importantly for our listeners who'd like to learn about Vinoce Wines and maybe a bit about you online, what is your website?
Yeah, come check us out at vinoce.com. It'd be great.
You did that like you knew it.
I do.
That's good. Keith, I appreciate you taking the time. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Ray. Appreciate it. Take care.
Learn more by visiting vinoce.com. Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Our intern is Clement Maddox. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.